Hard to believe now that about 6.5 years ago, I got a new hip. I had hip surgery. And it all went amazingly well, but just imagine if halfway through the surgery, okay, halfway through, I wake up and that pain blocker kind of stops. Oh, man, I imagine what I'd be thinking. This hurts. What's going on? Why do you have a saw at my hip? Is that my hip socket you're holding? Can you put this back together? Do you know what you're doing? And hopefully around then they'd have gotten maybe my grogginess and disorientation under control and were able to tell me, you know what? It's not all random. Someone's in control here. This is purposeful. And I could rest again. Well, it's certainly not a perfect analogy. And a lot of inconsistencies if you try and apply it to this, but let's try. I wonder how many of us these days are waking up in life and going, what's going on? Life hurts. Where's what I'm used to? Where's comfortable? Is anyone in control? And then why we don't want to, we start to ask the question, God, where are you? Are you in control? There's so many reasons people are asking those questions these days. The pandemic as it's lingering and the limitations stay. News from all around the world. Be it the States and the events of the week, be it this new strain, and we go, God, what's going on? And sometimes it's our own life, the loss. Loss of loved ones, loss of health, loss of what we knew in our employment situation, accidents. God, where are you? This is not a new question. All year we've been in the book of Isaiah, our ministry year. The first 39 chapters really are a word of warning to the people of God, saying you're on a path that's going to lead to some difficult consequences. They stayed on the path. The consequences come. Isaiah 40, Isaiah begins to prophetically speak to those people in the midst of the consequences. These are a people. Babylon has come in and taken over the southern kingdom of Israel. Jerusalem is in ruins, and these people have now been exiled, most of them. There's a few back in Jerusalem, but it's like their nation's gone, their capital's gone, their temple's gone, and they're in a foreign land. And you know what they're asking? Why? Where are you? Isaiah 40, verse 27. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? My cause is disregarded by my God. Where are you, God? Why is this happening? And Isaiah 40 answers the question. In fact, it answers two questions. The question behind the question is the first one, and we looked at this last week. God, have we messed up so bad that you've left us behind? Have we failed too miserably? And last week we saw no. Isaiah 41, verse 1 to 11, comfort my people. I'm coming. And then verse 11, I tend my flock like a shepherd. And we saw last week to a people wondering why and where are you, God? What we see is he has a posture toward us that is moving toward us and is open toward us and will embrace us as we come to him. Which leads to the second question. God, that's a nice promise, but are you able? It's such a mess. Are you capable of fixing the mess? And you know how he answers? He gives himself. He doesn't give a step-by-step description of how he's going to do it. We sure want that. Can you tell me exactly what tomorrow and 5 days from now and 6 months from now are going to look like? I'd like that, God. Instead, he gives us himself. Isaiah 40, verse 28. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary. You might be. He's not. And his understanding no one can fathom. I think what he's saying to us, you wouldn't get it if I told you. But look at me. And in Isaiah 40, starting at verse 12 through 28, that's the whole theme. Look at me. Look. And we're going to see some things we need to look at this morning. First of all, God says, look at creation. When you bump into the limits of your understanding, when you don't get it, look at creation. Story of someone having a conversation with a three-year-old. Those are so much fun. And says to the three-year-old, where did you get those big brown eyes? She thinks. She looks and says, I think they came with my head. Wisdom there. These eyes that work so amazingly and are so intricate and wonderful, they're part of a big design. That's what God's saying. God, why? What? Verse 12. What does he say? Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand? Or with the breadth of his hand marked off the heavens? Who's held the dust of the earth in a basket or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? We saw Annette trying to do that in the kids' video. Can't be done. Only God put all this in place. Did he need anyone to tell him how? Verse 14. Whom did the Lord consult to enlighten him? Who's taught him the right way? Who was it that taught him knowledge or showed him the path of understanding? God says, I did this. I don't need anyone to tell him. You look around at the grandeur of your creation. I've done it. Not only that, I keep it going every day. Verse 26. Lift up your eyes and look. Look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name. Each star he knows, each star in place, each star. Our sun in place, us going around it. God sustains all that. The more science finds out, the more we see the intricacy and the precision of a creation that's perfect. And that leaves us with a choice. To either recognize there is a designer behind this incredible design, or to go somehow it's random. And randomness, nowhere else do we say randomness goes to this kind of design. It's only if we don't want a creator. If you're listening today and you're still wondering how in a scientific world we can believe in a God, I urge you, read some stuff. Lee Strobel, Case for Creation. Google Francis Collins. This guy worked on the Genome Project. Brilliant mind who in the process of looking at it all saw the intricacy of creation and said there's got to be a God behind it. But most of us sitting here and listening today, I think we believe there's a creator. What's the implication of looking at that creator? Well, Tim Keller, I think he says it well when he thought back to a class he was in, a Christian teacher, who brought a piece of paper and said, this paper, let's assume that the width of the paper is the distance between Earth and the sun, okay, 92 million miles. That being the case, he said the next nearest star would be a stack of paper 70 feet high. And the diameter of the galaxy would be a stack of papers 310 miles high. Now, I can't fact check that. But if that's even a thimble close to the way it is, it's mind-boggling. And the teacher then said, But God holds it all. And then ask this question. If a God who holds something this great and made it, if that's how great He is, do you ask Him into your life to be an assistant? To do things your way, to keep it understandable? Look at the creation. The grandeur, the precision, the perfection of creation, the mind behind it. Why should we think we can understand? But if He designed that, like Jeannie said, it should lead us to the Word, to praise, to giving Him the day. Because if He can design the world, He can design my day, even if I don't get it. Look to creation. Then God says through Isaiah, look at history. Look at history. My kids growing up, the cartoons they watched, one of them was called Pinky and the Brain. They connect with any of it, maybe not. Two mice, okay? Pinky, big brain, really smart. Or no, that's the brain, sorry. Pinky is the sidekick, right, who doesn't know anything and just kind of the goofy comic part. And the conversation that went on every episode, Pinky comes to the brain and says, "What are we going to do today?" And the brain says, "We're going to take over the world." And that was the episode. And he would always fail. The people of Israel, I believe, were in a position where they thought the brain had just won. Babylon, this great power, had just taken over the world. And they were part of it. And there's nothing they can do about it because the brain is in control. That's the way it looked. Fascinating what God says in response. Let's go to verse 15. "Surely the nations are like a drop in a bucket. They are regarded as dust on the scales." He weighs the islands, and that word islands means the far-flung areas. Areas remote from here, He knows about. As though they were fine dust. What's He saying? All the nations and their movement, it's not the brain in control, it's God. Verse 23, "He brings princes to naught. He reduces rulers of the world to nothing. No sooner are they planted, no sooner are they sown, no sooner do they take root in the ground, than He blows on them and they wither. And a whirlwind sweeps them away like chaff." He's saying to these people, look at history. Right now it looks like there's a world power that's greater than me, but you exist still. Look at your history. There was a day you were nothing in the land of Canaan and a famine. Did I not preserve you and bring you to Egypt? And yes, you became slaves, and all the power of the pharaohs in Egypt looked like they were coming against you. But I delivered you, and I gave you a nation. And even as a nation, nation, a nation, a nation around you would come against you, you would turn to me, I would save you. And He would say to Jerusalem, even Assyria, who looked so powerful, were right at your doorstep. I delivered you. And you'd have thought Assyria was God. But Babylon revealed them to be nothing. And guess what? In the next chapters, I'm going to raise up Cyrus, Persia, and Babylon will be nothing. And then history is showing Greece came, and then Rome came. And it was Rome, Caesar Augustus. We read about him in the Christmas story. He was the first Caesar to declare, "I am God." And many of the Caesars after it followed him. That's why Christianity ran into trouble. They would not be able to say the Caesar is Lord because Jesus is Lord. So you have the Caesars coming against Christianity, trying to end God's people. Nero. Under Nero, Peter and Paul were executed. Today, the teaching of Peter and Paul, inspired by the Holy Spirit, is all over the world. Nero? He's a negative footnote. People name their children Peter, Paul. They have a big bulldog. They might name him Nero. Lord of history. You know, as God's people, we often get this, God has protected his people since he called Abraham. And he will protect the purposes of his people today. Look at history. See the big picture. And then he wants to tell us, having looked at creation, and that's kind of the near the beginning of this passage and another chunk near the end, look at history, same thing, right in the middle. And that means it's important, the way they set this stuff up in Hebrew language. Right in the middle, look at the futility of turning to things other than me. Look at the futility of idols. If I'm the one who made creation and rules history, look at the futility of trusting anyone other than me. Look at the futility of your idols. Now, we got to get a sense of the context. Back in those days, there was this idea of every nation or people had its own gods. So when war happened, the gods up there were fighting. And if you defeated, that means your gods defeated them. We get this Isaiah 39, verse 17. 37, verse 19. Let's go there. That works better. Assyria is surrounding Jerusalem, and the king Hezekiah is praying. He says, "It's true, Lord, that the Assyrian kings have laid waste all these people and their lands, and they've thrown their gods into the fire." You see that? If a nation defeated a nation, they would take the idols of the defeated nation and burn them and put in their own idols, because our gods are bigger than your gods. Okay? Just an ancient version of King of the Hill. But God's people know that these are not gods, but only wood and stone. Now, what's happening, you've been taken to Babylon. Jerusalem, the temple is destroyed. And now you're in Babylon. And you look around and you see a statue to Marduk, that Babylonian god, Anu, that Babylonian god, Enlil, that Babylonian god. And you start to wonder, do I need statues? Do I need idols? Do I need to make something so I can get control over the heavens and the gods again? And verse 18 says, "Whom then will you compare God? To what image will you liken him? As for an idol, a metal worker casts it. A goldsmith overlays it with gold, fashions silver chains for it. A person too poor presents such an offering, selects wood that will not rot. They look for a skilled worker to set up an idol that will not topple." Isaiah is saying, look it, you who think that the Babylonian gods and those idols are your salvation, think, look, they're man-made. Someone found some silver and made it. If they couldn't afford the silver, they looked for wood, but they knew they had to find wood that wouldn't rot. If an idol rots, why put your faith in it? And it's so easy for us to sit here and think, that was back then. Do you see, the essence of the idol, Isaiah is saying, is that humanity makes it, and then humanity looks at it for security and meaning in life. Why do you make something and look to what you have made to give it what you don't have? You've got to look to a maker, not what's made. And we say, well, we don't make little idols. Well, not little figurines. We make other things. I was reading, there was an orthopedic surgeon who said, he's having to treat a lot of cases of selfie wrist. Seriously, I'm not making this up. People who spend so much time making selfies, there's a carpal tunnel now that needs to be treated. And one of the people he treated, she said, "This is what I do for a living. I help people make an image of themselves. And it's in that image I find my security and I find my meaning and I'm able to present myself to people and look at me." pop. We try and make an image. We try and build a financial portfolio. And again, it's not like we don't need to manage our finances, but is that our security? Because if it is, we are going to be checking our investments all the time with great anxiety. And we're going to be mighty disappointed on that day when a health issue comes and we can't buy our way out of it. When we see people who have so much less, living so much more freely and peacefully, and we're weighed down trying to take care of and keep in place that which we've built as a foundation. You know, I think besides that, here's a big idol that's being exposed. I think we make an idol out of our plans. I'm going to take control of tomorrow. And again, I'm not saying we don't plan, but when we don't hold it loosely and have God as a God over the plan, we put the plan ahead of God. God, this is what next month needs to look like. This is what 6 months needs to look like. This is my 10-year plan. God, you know that, right? I've made it. Then he sends a little pandemic. Now, what do you think of your plans? Well, if they're not an idol, we think, okay, God, what are you showing me? How do you need to adjust? What do you need to change? But if they're an idol, I got to get back. I got to be in control. I got to know. God says, okay. You want to be stressed out? Whatever you make is not your security. It's not your ultimate hope. It's not your identity. Why do you make something and then think it will give you life instead of looking to the giver of life? You know, I think when we bump into the limits of our understanding, we try to get control, and it exposes the idols, whatever we turn to in those places instead of God is an idol. And out of love, God says, you know that's not going to come through. Look at creation. Look at history. I've proven myself true. Lean on me. And as a result, we come to the end of this, where the last thing we're to look to is to look in trust to God's wisdom. Look in trust to God's wisdom. This week, someone sent me a blog post, kind of a New Year's post. I think it was a Ann Voskamp website where she was quoting a guy named Mark Batterson. Mark talked about a story, goes back to 1979. A guy named Dennis Waitley had a plane to catch from Chicago to L.A. O'Hare Airport in Chicago, because Jeannie lives in that or grew up in that Chicago area. We have family there. We've been there a lot. It's big. You just don't get around quickly. And I don't know if he was making a connection or got to the airport late, but he's trying to get to his gate on time. And as he gets there, what happens? It's closed. And he does everything he can. Open the gate. I'm just me. Just me. Just get me in. And they wouldn't. And he's all frustrated and ticked off, and why? And this is going to wreck my plans. And he's making his way to the ticket counter to complain to the airline, to rebook, when news starts to break over the airport. 1979, on that day, that plane took off, lost an engine, crashed. Everyone on board died. You can look it up. Tons of questions around it, but for Dennis Waitley, all of a sudden, he began to see how little he knew and how much God knows. And he's forever kept the ticket as a reminder. Verse 27 and 28 again. "Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord? My cause is disregarded by my God." And I think God in his love is saying, I get that you ask why. But can you look at creation and history and the futility of everyone, every human attempt? And then look to God. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creators of the ends of the earth. He will not grow tired or weary. His understanding no one can fathom. He sees the beginning to the end. He sees how this impacts every person involved. He sees so much more than we see. We see a thimble. He sees the universe. His understanding no one can fathom. So verse 31, and we're going to take time here next week. Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. So hope in the Lord. Wait in the Lord. Put your trust in the Lord. That word wait is awful. We're going to talk about that next week. We don't want to wait. But trust that a God who put creation together, keeps it going every day, is in control of the flow of history and is taking it somewhere. Put your trust in the fact that this God knows more than you do. He is God and I am not. And he's on the throne. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week, but let me just give you one picture of how this worked for King David. When I did my doctoral work in Boston, we had a guy named Dwayne Litvin come and walk us through a number of passages that we were to preach on, and he pulled out one that I had never seen this before. Psalm 131, a psalm of David. My heart is not proud, Lord. My eyes are not haughty. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. I do not concern myself with great matters or things too wonderful for me. But I have calmed myself. Quieted myself, I am like a weaned child with its mother. Like a weaned child, I am content. In the preaching context, he was saying, look at the metaphors, look at the images in the poetry. Proud eyes, weaned child. Demanding answers, content. See, here's the thing about a weaned child. Weaned child means they're not just going to mom for milk. They're going because it's mom. Even as a grandma and grandpa, we know there are times grandma and grandpa aren't good enough. I need mom or dad. David is saying, I don't want the proud eyes. This is God. I demand an answer. Because he's God and I'm not. So I am learning to come to God just because he's God. And he's got it. And I'm in his presence. And while there are things too wonderful for me that I don't get, I get there is a God who has me in his arms. And when I bump up to the limits of my understanding, that's the picture God brings me. What does that lead him to? Verse 3, Israel, put your hope in the Lord, both now and forevermore. It leads him to praise. It leads him to focus on who God is. So maybe you find yourself having bumped up to the limits of your understanding. We all have. God is so far beyond our understanding. He's not our assistant who has to give us all the answers. He knows we probably couldn't fathom them anyway. But he says, I give you me. I've created this world, you see, and sustain it every day. I have worked through history so that you as my people exist today. I got your future. This is going somewhere. Everywhere you look outside of me, recognize you're the one making it. So don't look at what you made for what only a maker can give. And rest in me. Come to me not for answers, just for me. My love. My presence. And I'll give you strength. And I'll give you hope. And you will know my life. So God, we come. Father, I know in my own life this huge gap. We come to church on Sunday. We tune in online. The songs are sung. The whole earth is filled with your glory. There's one seated on the throne. You are God alone. And then I leave this place. And my posture becomes, I have worshiped instead of I will continue to worship. And God, how I need to continue to focus on what's true. I will worship with all of my heart. I will give you all my worship. God, just coming to you, not demanding, but expectant. Honest. Recognizing you alone are worthy of my praise. Because you alone are the one who is able to put it all back together in a way beyond what we can begin to ask or imagine. Your understanding is beyond anything we can fathom. And rather than let that frustrate us, may it comfort us as we worship you for your infinite wisdom and greatness. Let's stand.